First words, earliest writing from favorite contemporary authors, collected and edited by Paul Mandelbaum.
Alan Gurganis. Alan Gurganis made his literary debut in 1974, creating the first gay protagonist to appear in a New Yorker short story. The work had been submitted without Gurganis' knowledge by his mentor and admirer, John Cheever. 15 years later, Gurganis made an even bigger entrance with the publication of his first book, the acclaimed best-selling novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. It's a huge book, big-mouthed and big-hearted. Gloria Naylor, in her judge's report for the Book of the Month Club, wrote, according to New York Magazine, that she felt as deeply for Gurganis' Confederate citizens as she did for their slaves. In Garden Sermon, 1989, an essay about his novel's origins, Gurganis tells how in 1968, soon after being forced into the military, he made the ironic and upsetting discovery that his ancestors had been slave owners. That realization directed Gurganis to an engrossing and ever-widening theme, the moral consequences of one person's subservience to another. Garden Sermon also traces the author's voice to its beginnings. In the essay, Gurganis characterizes himself this way: I start as a stupidly well-brought-up young man, a young whitey of middle-class privilege, of country club dances in North Carolina. In reading the excerpt from Just the Idea of Being in Georgia that follows, we join this young man, 18 years after his birth, in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, in 1947, and shortly before he will discover his own disturbing Southern legacy. From Just the Idea of Being in Georgia, 1965, age 18. Luther's Dream. Luther Smythe dreamed he and his family were sitting quite naked on a very white beach. How peaceful and ridiculous our life is here, he thought, smiling at his wife, Millie. Her eyes flirted over the green husk of coconut she seemed to be drinking from. Earlier, the children had been kicking sand at one another and wading at the edge of the azure water, but they had now settled down nearby. Dennis, their son, sat smoothing sand over a second green coconut. His blonde hair, sun-bleached blonder, shone oddly in the tropical light. Some slight distance from them, facing inland, their daughter Cora sat, stripped of everything but her perpetual expression, pouting even here in paradise. Her chest, so recently like her brother's, was changed, Luther saw. Her faint nipples seemed to be pouting, too. Millie saw Luther watching Cora. She dropped her coconut on the sand and crawled over to her husband on all fours, her own breasts framed, pendulous, between her stiff, moving arms. Sand flew as she scrambled toward him. Luther noticed abruptly that only he was clothed, wearing the paint-spattered khakis he used for working in their little garden back in Cambridge. Millie crawled up, knelt beside him, and whispered into his ear, over the sound of the surf, which he had not noticed until now. Cora bores me, Luther. She is our daughter, certainly, but can children be bores? I think Cora's one. 2. Luther woke with the conviction that they should all go to the tropics. The sooner the better. 4 weeks later, at 60 miles an hour, they were returning from a compromised fulfillment of his dream, 2 weeks camping in Florida. A long dent in the radiator grill gave the snoutish front of the Citroën the look of a squint or grimace. 2 years earlier, the left rear door snapped open while turning a corner. It refused afterwards to shut, and had since been tied closed with the cord of a broken Venetian blind. Headed due north on U.S. 301, Luther Smythe drove the Citroën wagon he'd bought new 11 years ago with money his parents gave him when he finally got his master's from Harvard. An aluminum canoe longer than the car was overturned on top of it, held there by a network of twine and ropes. The car wore it like a helmet with numerous chin straps. Millie's red bandana, so recently her halter, had been tied to the back end of the boat and now swam straight.